Brian Lehrer with you on WNYC, and Rice University historian Douglas Brinkley is with us now. His much acclaimed and diverse body of work includes The Unfinished Presidency, Jimmy Carter's Journey Beyond the White House, which some credit for helping Carter win the Nobel Peace Prize, Wheels for the World, Henry Ford, His Company, and A Century of Progress. Brinkley was Rosa Parks' official biographer, and he is the literary executor of the late journalist Hunter S. Thompson's work. Brinkley said recently that he's surprised a serious third-party candidate hasn't emerged so far in the presidential election. We'll ask him about that. The book that brought him to prominence was Dean Acheson, The Cold War Years, published in 1992, and in a way, his new book returns to Cold War America. It's a biography of CBS News anchor Walter Cronkite, simply called Cronkite. Douglas Brinkley, great to have you back on WNYC. Congratulations on this 800-page book.
Well, thank you so much. It's a privilege to be on your show.
I think this is your only book with a one-word title and without even your subject's first name. Is it because Cronkite is that much of a singular icon?
That's right. You know, you play with all sorts of title ideas, and I recognize all I have to do is say I'm working on a Cronkite biography, and his name recognition is quite astounding. We grew up, everybody alive today really grew up with television, and Walter Cronkite was there at the inception of it. He started with CBS in 1950 covering the Korean War, and he only died a few years ago. So he was a regular presence in our lives, and he had, more than anybody else, he was the most successful TV broadcaster in U.S. history, and I treat him as a major journalist, as you would Edward R. Murrow or Walter Lippmann.
Your book is getting written up for some of the darker sides of Cronkite that you write about in this biography, and we'll get to some of that. But from my reading of it, the context is still that you celebrate him as, quote, the most trusted man in America when he anchored the CBS Evening News from 1962 to 1981. Who gave him that nickname?
It was a what was called the Quail Poll, and it happened in 1972. And on the list was, you know, people like Spiro Agnew and Richard Nixon, you know, George McGovern and others, mainly politicians. And Cronkite got put on the ballot by the Quail Poll, and everybody checkmarked Walter Cronkite. It was very insignificant in a way, except the publicist at CBS News jumped on it. They saw that this was a good advertising campaign, and so they started calling Cronkite the most trusted man in America, and it stuck because by 72, there was a lot of distrust swirling around. The youth culture, young people didn't trust the older generation, the baby boomer class. Vietnam had everybody pointing fingers at each other. You know, we had Watergate boiling and things like the Pentagon Papers and My Lie, and here was Walter Cronkite, still liked by everybody. Nobody ever got tired of having Cronkite deliver the nightly news, and we are America that was a big three media and television, meaning CBS, NBC, and ABC, and some markets, many markets, only got CBS News, so Cronkite had something of a monopoly in parts of the country.
You say people never got tired of him. I saw that Ted Turner quote in your book where he said, Cronkite was the only person in TV that people never got sick of.
Well, that's right, and I thought about that hard. I suppose in the entertainment field, Johnny Carson may have been the same way. But, you know, Cronkite really did a couple of things that were crucial to make him an historic figure. First off, during World War II, he worked for the United Press, and he covered as a print reporter events like D-Day and the Battle of the Bulge, and after the war, the Nuremberg trials. And then he became the chief Moscow correspondent for UP. And when he broke into television, you know, he grabbed on to space, and that seemed like a backbeat. Who was going to go down to Cape Canaveral, Florida? What was the story of the rockets just taking off? But Cronkite owned that beat, and he, by the time Kennedy became president, Alan Shepard, followed by John Glenn, became our national heroes, and Cronkite was doing these marathon dramatic broadcasts of the space launches. And then, of course, you have the Kennedy assassination, when Cronkite famously teared up on the air and fidgeted with his glasses and reported the president's death in Dallas and became something akin to a pastor in chief, a healer through that long, torturous weekend, which culminated in President Kennedy being buried at Arlington. And from around that point onwards, everybody in America started, looking towards Cronkite to offer sanity among all the chaos.
Douglas Brinkley, the historian, with his new book, Cronkite. We'll also get to some things that he has to say about this year's presidential race. But, yeah, people who lived through that era usually cite exactly the same things that you just did. His anchoring of the moon landing in 1969, end of the President Kennedy assassination, two signature moments that represented TV news bringing the nation together in triumph and in tragedy, almost that pastoral way, as you say. And there was his conclusion after visiting Vietnam in 1967 that the war was headed for a stalemate, an instance where a journalist's observation actually probably affected politics and public opinion. And I want to play that clip. Since we were talking earlier about the 50th anniversary of the start of the war being observed now, here is 37 seconds of Walter Cronkite.
It seems now more certain than ever that the bloody experience of Vietnam is to end in a stalemate. This summer's almost certain standoff will either end in real give-and-take negotiations or terrible escalation. And for every means we have to escalate, the enemy can match us. And that applies to invasion of the North, the use of nuclear weapons, or the mere commitment of 100 or 200 or 300,000 more American troops to the battle. And with each escalation, the world comes closer to the brink of cosmic disaster.
And Professor Brinkley, correct me, was it 1967 or 68?
That was 1968, and it happened at the Tet Offensive. He was in New York, and he got the cable traffic and recognized, my gosh, Lyndon Johnson and McNamara, Secretary of Defense, were saying there was light at the end of the tunnel. General Westmoreland, the whole gang was saying we're going to win in Vietnam. And here was the Tet Offensive with the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese wreaking havoc in South Vietnam. So Cronkite, even though he was a famous anchorman, hopped on a plane and got into Vietnam and embedded with troops and traveled the countryside, came to the conclusion, and I've been able to read his notebooks from Vietnam. They're at the Briscoe Center at the University of Texas in Austin Archive, that he came back and decided he was going to have to leave being Mr. Center, Mr. Objectivity, and become essentially join the dove crowd and say that at best it was going to be a stalemate there, that we couldn't win the war. And when he did that, it had a huge ripple effect. And weeks later, Lyndon Johnson announced that he was not running for re-election. There's some correlation between the Cronkite announcement and Johnson's refusal to run for re-election, because Cronkite said some version of, if I've lost Cronkite, I've lost Middle America. And Walter Cronkite's reputation just grew. He brilliantly covered the Bobby Kennedy's assassination, Martin Luther King in 68. And then at the Democratic Convention in Chicago, Mayor Daley's police started beating and clubbing reporters, including Dan Rather. And Cronkite called the Daley police a bunch of thugs on the air, and it created a huge brouhaha. And nobody was ever really able to make a dent in Walter Cronkite's armor. American people believed in his brand, so to speak, and he had a kind of carte blanche to do and say what he wanted.
And not to say he was wrong about Vietnam, but as a matter of journalism, CBS had reporters on the ground there full time. And yet when Cronkite, as the anchor, flew in for a tour, maybe you could tell me how long he was actually there. It's almost an act of, parachute journalism. They do it all the time now. The networks will fly their anchors somewhere, and it looks like the anchor is there covering the story. And maybe they're doing a little real journalism, but mostly they're being flown in so they can say that they're on the scene. How much time did Cronkite spend in Vietnam before he concluded to America that it was a stalemate?
Well, he first went in the summer of 1965 to Vietnam, but there a problem occurred, and that was Cronkite was always very enamored and dazzled with machinery. It's why he loved rockets and airplanes and military vehicles. And the U.S. government gave him a tour, kind of showed him what they wanted to show him in 65. And he also got an earful of dissent from Morley Safer, CBS correspondent then in Vietnam, who told Cronkite as early as 65 that the Pentagon's lying, Johnson's lying, we're not getting true reports out of Vietnam. Walter came back, and he loved Morley Safer. They were lifelong friends, but decided he was sticking with Johnson. In other words, he was really – the CBS News in 65, 66, and 67 sort of supported the Vietnam War. Occasionally, they would run a piece that was, about our soldiers, burning thatch huts down with Zippo lighters or something that were controversial. But they were pretty much in sync. So when Cronkite went in 68, it was a realization that he was listening to the Pentagon all these years instead of his own embedded reporters, the Morley Safer, and Jack Lawrence in particular. And he sided now with his reporters in 68. He came and did a week of circulating in early 68 and then came back. And he did that at prime time, the clip he played, not on the evening news. He did a CBS special report on Vietnam. And that was his editorial at the end of it. But it was a major moment in his career, and it's made him a historic figure. There were other TV reporters that are going to be forgotten, but Cronkite's wing in was a kind of Edward R. Murrow-like moment. He really put skin in the game in Vietnam, and history's treated him pretty well for it.
Historian Douglas Brinkley with his new 800-page biography of Walter Cronkite, just called Cronkite. And I want to play one other clip of Cronkite. This is about 2 minutes worth of Cronkite explaining his sign-off that became so iconic and ubiquitous and that his subsequent successors at CBS News on the anchor desk, Dan Rather and others, have tried to figure out their own version of, and that is when he ended the evening news, he said, "And that's the way it is." And we're going to hear in this clip about the critique from his boss that the evening news was only one small piece of the way it is and why Cronkite stuck with it anyway.
Well, I had the naive idea that with a half hour, we'd have time at the end of the broadcast for a little quirk of fate story, one of those one or two paragraph stories, which could be either happy or sad or sardonic or whatever. And I thought it needed, I just couldn't drop that into the end of the broadcast without some kind of a punchline at the end. And I searched for one that could be used in any of those circumstances and used equally well. You can laugh over it, oh, that's the way it is, or sardonic, that's the way it is, or sad, well, that's the way it is. And so I adopted it, didn't tell Dick Salamp, president of CBS, of doing it, went on the air with it, and was called into his office, or he called from home. He went home every evening earlier. He called from home and said, "What in the world is that business you're doing?" And I tried to explain it. He said, "I don't like it. I don't like it. I'll talk to you tomorrow about it." When he came in, he complained the next day that he didn't like it, and he didn't like it primarily for a very good reason. He said, "You're telling people that's the way it is. Well, we can make mistakes in that broadcast. It's not necessarily the way it is. You're bragging about something we can't produce." Well, I realized he was right about it, but by that time, a couple of days had gone by, and people were already commenting on it. It just caught on instantly. And I pointed out to him that distinguished broadcasters like Edward R. Murrow would have their sign-off line. His was "Good night and good luck." And Lowell Thomas, "So long until tomorrow," and so forth. And all these guys had them, and why shouldn't I have one? Well, he yielded to let us try it, and it did just, it built, it snowballed into something people seemed to appreciate. So we went ahead and did it, despite the fact that he was right, that maybe we shouldn't have made that statement.
Despite the fact that he was right, his boss, Dick Salant, maybe we shouldn't have made that statement, going on every night and saying that's the way it is. Walter Cronkite, from a collection of Cronkite clips, by the way, on the website, hark.com. hark.com, H-A-R-K.com. And Douglas Brinkley, that really raises an interesting journalistic question, doesn't it? That was the height of the so-called objectivity era, where the three major networks, as the dominant forces in news dissemination, were trying to cultivate this air of neutrality and objectivity and trying to let people know that they thought that's the way it really was, and earnestly at that. But there was not such an era in journalism before that where people more read their many newspapers with their many points of view. And we're out of that era now with so many different, web-based sites and web-based journalism and different kinds of voices on cable television. Do you agree that that was of a particular moment? And there, even Cronkite admitting that, well, you can't really say that.
Well, yes, I agree with that. And let me add, and that's the way it is, was a takeoff of Edward R. Murrow during World War II on CBS Radio during Operation Market Garden, which was our American gliders coming into the Low Countries, Holland and Belgium, Luxembourg, was on a plane, and he ended a broadcast saying, and that's the way it was. So that stuck in Cronkite's mind, and he just changed it a little bit. Edward R. Murrow is a huge figure in my book. But remember, when you're talking about objectivity in the 60s, there was still this we're all in this together mentality. After all of our reporters during World War II basically were propagandists for the U.S. cause. Cronkite was writing for the United Press just how great our flyboys are, and we're going to rain hell on you, Adolf Hitler. And all of these reporters that later went on to famous TV and Eric Severider, Andy Rooney, on and on, Charles Collingwood, really were working in tandem with the U.S. government. So when you look at Cronkite, say, promoting NASA, I was mentioning the Mercury program, he's working with the U.S. government. The change in all of this on all fronts is Vietnam, and particularly then Watergate, because Woodward and Bernstein made a huge splash in journalism with going after Nixon's illegal activities in the Watergate break-in, and Cronkite gave credence to it. The big moment for Cronkite in my book is really when he's the main guy who gives – with the reputation who backs Woodward and Bernstein's journalism, and Cronkite in 72 does too long, eats up most of the clock of his nightly news on an investigation of Nixon and Watergate, up until Cronkite, Watergate was back page news. And after Watergate, after Johnson's kind of taken down by Vietnam and reporters like Cronkite and Johnny Apple and David Halberstam and Neil Sheehan and others, then you get Woodward and Bernstein on Nixon and other reporters going after him. You had two presidents gone because of tough investigative journalism, and a backlash occurred, and it started with Ronald Reagan in 81, where all reporters were banned from the Grenada invasion in 1983, and Cronkite screamed bloody murder about this. He thought the Fourth Estate was losing power, and since then you find it harder and harder to get a kind of elite news core like CBS News was working on TV, because all of our foreign bureaus have disappeared, many of them. And so you're getting a lot more entertainment as news, celebrity news, and we're not really covering the Philippines or China or Japan or wherever as we should, or as Cronkite wanted to. During his reign, he wasn't just the anchorman, he was the managing editor of CBS. He was like Duke Ellington with his orchestra. He had all these great players, Leslie Stahl and Harry Reasoner, Roger Mudd, Dan Rather. They were all doing deep investigative reporting, and budgets have been slashed in that regard now, and people prefer just to do entertainment news and not use broadcast television to do investigatory work.
We'll continue in a minute with historian Douglas Brinkley, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with historian Douglas Brinkley. His new book is Cronkite, a biography of Walter Cronkite. And we'll talk politics with him as well, getting his take on this presidential race in historical context. And Professor Brinkley, let's get into some of the lesser known things that you write about in the book. In 1952, Cronkite bugged a committee room at the Republican convention. You tell us something that could get a journalist fired today.
Well, it could get anybody put in jail today. Well, Cronkite and Don, you know, they were inventing how to cover conventions in 1952. There were a few TV cameras in 48, but not really. I mean, they just caught, like, newsreel footage. But 52, a deal was made, or was starting to be made, to cover these conventions, except with the Republican nomination was Dwight Eisenhower versus Robert Taft. And the Taft crowd, the conservatives of the Republican Party, did not want TV cameras in there because Robert Taft was a little duller. And if you bring cameras and TV, you're going to give the benefit to Ike, who was this wildly popular, charismatic World War II hero. So the Taft, Cronkite and Don Hewitt and others bugged the room of the Taft committee room and got information and started telling them all that they knew and used it as a kind of a blackmail way to make the Taft people to capitulate to allowing the cameras in there, which Eisenhower wanted. It gets further complicated because William Paley, the famous founder of CBS, worked for Dwight Eisenhower in World War II and was a true Eisenhower Republican and wanted Eisenhower president. So there's some arguments can be made that 52 was extremely important of getting Ike the nomination, that CBS kind of played in with Ike. And Cronkite gave a course in how to look good on TV. And two of his students in this seminar were John F. Kennedy and Sam Rayburn, how to look, put makeup on properly, how to talk in sound bites. And finally, by covering 1952 convention, what changed America forever, because with CBS bringing all of this live, they became an infomercial. And now all of our conventions, the ones coming up this year, are infomercials for the Republican and Democratic Party. They used to be brokered and deal making and all of that, but TV cameras changed it. Right. Now we do the brokering during caucus and primary system, which has taken hold. So it really changed things a lot. But Cronkite did something quite unethical, but he wasn't alone. It was a group of them at CBS.
You talked about John F. Kennedy being in a class with Cronkite. I hadn't heard that before, how to look good on television. But you also write about how he encouraged Robert Kennedy to run for president in 1968. Did that show Cronkite was too close to a person and maybe a party he was supposed to be covering?
Of course it does. But, you know, I have to be a historian. We have to live in that real era and not put our presentism. Think about what would happen today, a serious reporter doing that. It was just a different era. There was more of a boys' club aura. I mean, after all, nobody ever showed photographs of FDR in a wheelchair, even in the papers. And John F. Kennedy's extramarital affairs were widely known by reporters, and they weren't reported. And Cronkite fought when he went to Vietnam. He was I can't tell your listeners how Cronkite was sickened by what he saw in Vietnam, the dead bodies, the failures. And he felt that it was a moral imperative as a human being, which was more important than Anchorman, that as a person, a citizen of the globe, he had to stop what was going on in Vietnam. And his best shot at that in 68 was getting Bobby Kennedy to challenge Lyndon Johnson for the Democratic nomination. Kennedy had come out strongly about withdrawing from Vietnam. So after he did his broadcast that you played a clip of, he then raced to Capitol Hill and met with Bobby Kennedy and urged him to run for president. Kennedy jokingly said, "Well, I'll run for president, Walter, if you run for my New York Senate seat," because Bobby Kennedy was a senator. And Frank Mankiewicz, the press secretary, was in the room for all of this, and I had interviewed him. For my book, I've interviewed over 150 people, and so I'm able as a reporter to get a lot of stories about what really went on during these decades.
From our website, Jerry writes, "Nowadays we have this image of Walter Cronkite almost overcome with emotion as he announces the death of JFK. This is ironic in the fact that JFK felt Cronkite to be unfair to him in his reporting. Perhaps Professor Brinkley would care to comment." Is that true? Did JFK feel as president that Cronkite was unfair to him?
Well, I write about in the book in 1960, you know, Cronkite was one of the people who participated in the famous Kennedy-Nixon debates. But where JFK was angry is Cronkite went and interviewed both Nixon and Kennedy on separate kind of profiles, Q&A, and he did his of Kennedy at the home in Georgetown of JFK in 60. Ted Sorensen and JFK were laying on a bed just like a fraternity. Cronkite came in. They set up the cameras. They did the interview, and it just fell flat. Kennedy didn't have answers to simple questions. And on his way out to the CBS truck, suddenly Sorensen and others came running out and said, get back. JFK wants a redo. And Cronkite said, there is no redo. I did it in a taping. We're running it. And in a brouhaha ensued over it. Cronkite won, but it angered JFK towards Cronkite. He thought Cronkite was a closet Eisenhower Republican because of the Bill Paley connection. And finally, Cronkite seemed to raise the Catholic issue a lot on his broadcast. Kennedy is Catholic. Be like a reporter today or an anchor constantly, you know, doing bits on the Mormon Mitt Romney. And Kennedy thought that was an unfair pool. But I would not call it a huge feud between Cronkite and Kennedy. It was low simmering. And in fact, when CBS did its first half an hour broadcast of the nightly news in September of 63, his first guest was President Kennedy, and they made a lot of news in Hyannisport together talking about Vietnam War. 2 months later, Kennedy was dead.
Historian Douglas Brinkley, his new book, Cronkite. Dennis from our website writes, my favorite quote from Cronkite was only about a decade ago. Quote, two forces drive war, national pride and human loss. The first starts wars, the second sustains them. The first casualty creates an investment in blood that retreat would seem to dishonor. Did Cronkite say that?
Well, Cronkite would make these sort of philosophical comments all the time, and it was one of the joys. I mean, I'm dealing with the man who kept detailed notes, corresponded, was fast on his feet, maybe did more interviews than about anybody, because he was a huge public phenomenon, and everybody wanted to meet Cronkite. I mean, he was almost like American royalty, and he proved to be right about most of his things. He's philosophical about that. Quote leads to a concept of Cronkite as almost a pacifist. He loved animals, and he wouldn't even kill a spider or an insect. He would scoop them outside on a piece of cardboard. He always had just cats all around him. In fact, when he died at the UN Plaza in New York, he had two cats laying on top of him. He was a mensch in many ways, very sweet person, but James Minchner, his buddy, the great writer, novelist, one of Cronkite's closest friends, was a Quaker pacifist, and Cronkite was, although he was Episcopalian, he was attracted to pacifism. He had seen a lot of war, World War II and Vietnam in particular, and he thought we needed to do more to not get into war. So as an octogenarian, in his 80s, he protested the first Gulf War. He thought it was a mistake, and he really went after George W. Bush for the second war, the war in Iraq. In fact, he was so angry, Cronkite started writing a column for King Syndicate, that papers that just hammered George W. Bush's war in Iraq, weapons of mass destruction, more than any really living columnist in America at the time. He became more and more a man of the left as he grew older and was all about a non-intervention in global conflicts.
And yet in the book you say it was partly his centrism that made him the most trusted man on television. Was that just a presenting style rather than a centrist sensibility, since he came out later on as a liberal?
You know, I once read Norman Mailer once said he was I'm going to misquote him, but Mailer once called himself a leftist conservative. And that was sort of Cronkite. He was very conservative in his personal life. You know, he liked to wear nice clothes. He liked fine dining. He was an establishment figure. He had a house in Edgartown. He liked yachting. He was classic establishment figure, yet intellectually, he was a man of the left. And things that moved him a lot, I write in the book about we talk about Cronkite in space and Neil Armstrong and all of this, but he saw lonely, fragile Earth out there with no boundaries or borders, just a blue-green planet floating in this universe, and he was very moved by that. Steve Jobs was, too, of these photos of just Earth. Many Americans were. many astronauts found it almost religious to see Earth like that. And Cronkite started believing that we have to work in a more global fashion and less of this nation versus nation. And so, you know, he was always a man of philosophical surprises, but usually a person of deep integrity.
But I wonder if this is why Fox News and MSNBC had to come along in a way. Cronkite and, to a large degree, his counterparts at ABC and NBC were the liberal establishment, unsatisfying to the right for being liberal, unsatisfying to the left for being the establishment.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's what the Nixon crowd claimed. The truth is those anchors came from all over. Cronkite grew up poor in Missouri and Texas, and, you know, people like Chet Huntley and David Brinkley all came up hard-scrabbled ways. Nevertheless, they lived in Manhattan Island, and they ate at the same clubs and the same restaurants, and it was a bit of a set, East Coast set. But the reason you have the birth of cable came about as a side result of all these NASA programs. And in 1962, Cronkite were broadcast Telestar, which was the first broadcast of transmitting TV from Europe to the United States. Now it's done all the time on cable. And that beginning of satellite technology allowed there to be a kind of floating condominiums where you can rent cable networks out there. And so by 1981, when Cronkite steps down at just the right time, I mean, CNN's like a year and a half old or something, C-SPAN just created, there was never going to be a big three anymore. That power of those three networks had been broken up, not by Nixon and Agnew, but by technology. And so I'm looking at a figure. We'll never again have a media figure as powerful as Cronkite was in the 60s and 70s and very early 80s.
And I guess we should clarify that you, Douglas Brinkley, are not related to David Brinkley, late of ABC News, who you mentioned, correct?
I am not. And when I first met Walter Cronkite, you mentioned I wrote a book on Dean Acheson way back in the early 90s. I was at a book signing, and Cronkite, and it was at a private home, and Cronkite was there, and I saw him queuing up to get a book signed, and I was very flattered. And when he got up to me, and I was a little nervous, there's Walter Cronkite, he started saying, "Well, last time I saw you was in North Carolina on the boat, and da-da-da." And I started realizing he thought I was David Brinkley's son. And I wasn't, and I had a moment, do I tell him I'm not of that Brinkley clan or not? And I told him, and he got a surprised look on his face, a little embarrassed, and he said, "Well, I'm a big fan of Dean Acheson. I look forward to reading your book." And I kind of watched him slink out of the room.
So it can go with anybody. All right, we're almost out of time. Let me get one caller in. John in Paramus, you're on WNYC. Hi, John.
How you doing? He was forced to retire, I guess, because CBS has a mandatory age of retirement. Did he go peacefully, or did he fight to stay on the air?
Good question. He quit in 1981. He was 64, and he's 65 back then, was almost mandatory retirement. He wanted to go out on the top of his game. His ratings were sky high when he quit. He deeply regretted it a year later. He still got paid $1 million a year by CBS. They had him do a primetime show called Universe, which was sort of like what you might find on the Discovery Channel now. But the show rate well, and Cronkite didn't get a lot of special reports, and a huge animosity occurred between Dan Rather, who succeeded Cronkite, and a feud occurred in the 80s. Cronkite felt a little bit old in the way he wasn't particularly treated well by CBS, and he couldn't track. He did things for PBS and Discovery and CNN. They were good. He did a lot of good documentaries, but he deeply regretted he didn't stay in the main game maybe 5 years longer.
Let me just get your very quick take on the presidential race. You were quoted recently saying you were surprised no centrist third-party candidate has emerged. What were you expecting and why?
Well, maybe I was looking at Ross Perot and how, when in 1992, how somebody like Perot with some money could come in and get, you know, I think it was 19% or something of the vote. I might be off a percent or two.
I think that was their number. I do think that's right.
Yeah, and I mean, and I think we're in a climate where a serious third-party candidate could have mixed things up. But alas, the money takes so great that to be a third-party candidate and be taken seriously, you almost have to be a billionaire like Mayor Bloomberg or somebody. And most of those people don't have the stomach for that sort of investigation into your whole life and the topsy-turviness of it all. So we're back to being Mitt Romney versus Barack Obama and what I think will be an absolute dead heat in a election very much like 2000 between Bush-Gore and 2004 between Bush-Kerry. Cliffhangers all dependent on the same five or six states. We're still living in the great blue-red divide.
Maybe Perot getting 19% of the popular vote and that translating to zero electoral votes still serves as a cautionary tale to those who would try. And this year is reminding some of 1980 and 2004. Are these the years that most resonate historically for you, both years with incumbent presidents with controversial records, Jimmy Carter and George W. Bush? Of course, Carter was not reelected. Bush was. And one theory is the Bush camp did a better job of making the challenger, John Kerry, an unacceptable alternative than Carter did with Reagan. Do you see that as an essential parallel with this year?
Well, they're fun to look at. In 2004, it was a national security election. Really, we were still healing from 9/11, and Bush had got us into Iraq. Congress went along with it, and there was a feeling of let's not change that. We were just creating homeland security. We hadn't been attacked before, and I think President Bush had that helping him. In 80, it's the one that today's Republican Party wants to talk about. They want to paint Barack Obama's Jimmy Carter, a one-termer, many ways a moral leader, liked in different places around the world, but oversaw a stagnant economy and had a problem with Iran. And you might see this stagnant economy in the fall and a problem with Iran. So they like to echo it. But I think it's. I look at 2000 in 2004 because I think we're just still torn. It's like two visions. We're living in the age of Reagan. There's a feeling that the federal government went too far during the Great Society, and we need to rein in government spending. And it's hard for a progressive to get elected like Obama unless he triangulates like Bill Clinton and tries to cut the middle ground. And you see him doing that while not and very ably, President Obama, while not alienating his base.
Historian and Rice University history professor Douglas Brinkley, his new book, Cronkite. Thank you so much for spending all this time with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, author John Irving.